Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello, we're beginning the study of Esther today. This is a very unusual little book. It's, of course, in the Persian period. There's been some discussion about exactly when during the Persian period the Septuagint and Josephus have Artaxerxes II instead of Ahasuerus in verse 1:1. But I think most scholars and ancient commentators agree that Ahasuerus is the Hebrew form of the king that was known in Greek as Xerxes I. And so he would reign from 486 to 465 B.C. And that's the setting. This book has caused a lot of problems for the fact that the name of God never appears, prayer never appears, worship is never spoken of, Jerusalem's never mentioned, the law is only mentioned in one oblique reference. The cultus is not mentioned. Palestine's not mentioned. It's really been curious. And there's been some disagreement about should it even be in the canon, matter of fact. The Qumran, we found fragments of every book in the Bible but Esther. Rabbi Samuel said it's apocryphal. And yet a middle age medieval Jewish commentator, Maimonides, said it's next to the Torah in significance. Luther didn't like it much either. He said it should be excluded from the canon because it Judaizes too much, along with 2 Maccabees. He didn't like that one at all either. So there's been some discussion about this book. Basically, we think that the Council of Pharisees that kind of unofficially set the canon of the Old Testament in Jamnia in about A.D. 90 included it because it gives the background to the Feast of Purim. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about the Feast of Purim. It's not a Levitical feast. It's not mentioned in the Law of Moses. And from Leviticus 27:34, the Jews should not do anything that's not in the Law of Moses. And yet this became a very important feast to the Jews. And some say that's why some of the rabbis don't like it, because it's not listed in the book of Moses. But I think it's significant. I think it does have a tremendous historical value. The author of this book really knows the Persian period and the geographical sites around Susa, the capital of Persia, along with intricate knowledge of the palace and the intrigue that went on there. As far as authorship, there's been a lot of speculation. Rabbi Azariah says it was the high priest Jehoiakim. The Talmud says it's the men of the great synagogue. Ibn Ezra, Clement of Alexandria, and Josephus says it's Mordecai himself. Some say it's an unknown Jew familiar with the Persian court. And Augustine and Isidore says it was Ezra. So obviously we don't know who wrote it. But the man was obviously an eyewitness, lived in the Persian period, knew the court, knew the palace, and all of that. Now, there's been some discussion about the Hebrew of this book. It's very good, except for a few places. The Septuagint adds quite a bit to this book. And where the additions came from, we really don't know. It adds the prayers of Esther and Mordecai that aren't included here. And we just don't know the relationship between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. So let's go, if we could, to... by the way, this is one of the 5 megalos, or the little scrolls. Each one of those 5 books, little bitty books, is read at a different feast. The Song of Songs and Ruth. And Esther is one of those 5 little books called the Megaloth, included in the writing section of the Hebrew canon. Okay, verse 1. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, and that is the Hebrew form of this Persian ruler. His Persian spelling is K-H-S-H-A-Y-A-R-S-H-A. No wonder the Jews had trouble pronouncing that. In Greek, he's known as Xerxes I, okay? Now, Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia. Now, Cambyses, Cyrus's son, did not control India. So it fits historically from what we know, the headwaters of the Indus River, and that would be India. And the word Ethiopia is the word Kush. We think it's close to that modern place in Africa. Over 127 provinces. In those days, King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which is in Susa, later called Shushan, the capital. And we, of course, know that from in our talking about Cyrus spent so much time in Susa and so much time in Ecbatana and so much time in Babylon. And that seems to be true here in this days. Thus it says, in the 3rd year of his reign. Now, many historical commentators, and by the way, there is no good, real commentary on Esther. The Anchor Bible has one, but I disagree with it. The Broadman Commentary has one. I don't like it particularly. Pulpit Commentary, but the best that's available, and it's not really super. I wanted to mention to you, this is the best introduction to the Old Testament I ever found. It's called Introduction to the Old Testament by R.K. Harrison. It'll be very helpful in some of these books where there is not a real good commentary. Now, these commentators and historians say that in the third year of his reign, Xerxes had dominated Egypt again. They had revolted. He had put the revolt down. But he always wanted to do what Darius the First could never do. That was his daddy, Darius the First, Hastrepes. And so he wanted to conquer Greece. And in the third year is when these planning began to take place about how to do this Greek campaign. He's going to be defeated, by the way, but he's going to plan it. He gave a banquet for all the princes, attendants, army officers of Persia, and Media. Notice Media and Persia still go together. They are very closely associated with the book of Daniel and these post-exilic books. And the princes of prophets begin being in his presence. Now look at verse 4. You see the 180 days in verse 4, and you see the 7 days in verse 5. There's been some discussion if there is two different feasts, one that lasted 6 months for all the important officials, and then one, a later one, just the next, right next week, that lasted 7 days for all the people in Susa. But I really think that we can solve a lot of the problems here if we just realize the 180 days was the period for these people together, and the 7 days was the feast. And so I think there's one feast instead of two, though the Hebrew text is not, can't be certain or dogmatic about it. Okay, let's see. And we think this is related to the Greek campaign. We find that this mentioned in Herodias chapter 7, verse 19. And Herodotus really helps us in this book. We have a lot of confirmation of the Persian period from Herodotus. And until we learn how to decipher Persian, that's the only history we had, was Herodotus. Now notice that this 7-day feast is going to be for all the people, men in the capital, leaders and nobles. We learn again from Herodotus there were 7 special families that was surrounded the king. He's supposed to take his chief wife from one of those families. And so here we have the setting of a planning for the Greek war, and the king's going to give a lavish banquet, and the queen's going to give a banquet at the same time. Some of the beautiful description of the capital in Susa is described in verse 6 and 7, and we have archaeologically confirmed the splendor of this palace. Herodotus chapter 7, verse 27, talks about some of this splendor, and you might want to see the history of Herodotus. In verse 7, it says they were drinking from golden vessels of various kinds. This shows an eyewitness account. Each gold vessel was slightly different. We also learn from Herodotus again, chapter 3, verse 96, of the wide variety of gold vessels found at one of the campsites of Persia that the Greeks overran. Thus it mentions in verse 8 that the drinking was done according to the law, and there was no compulsion, for so the king had given orders to each official in his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. There's been 2 ways to interpret this. The Persians were known for their drinking bouts. And so that's just history, and it's common knowledge. But what does it mean according to the law? Well, some think that as the king drank, everyone had to drink, but that they could take just a sip or drink the whole cup. It was up to them how much they drank, but they had to drink when the king drank, at least a little bit. And that seems to be the idea here we learn from history. Verse 9. Here we have the first mention of Vashti. Now, the etymology of many of these names, Mordecai, Esther, Vashti, are uncertain. It was very popular a few years ago to try to link them to certain Babylonian gods or Sumerian gods or Elamite gods. Now, that was a presupposition primarily. Vashti may mean beautiful woman. Seems to be the Persian possibility here, but we're just not sure. From history, again, Herodotus, the only wife we know is Amestris, a very cruel and domineering woman who Xerxes the First was a little nervous about. And how Vashti and Esther and Amestris is related, we just don't know. But it's obvious this man had a large harem, and how exactly they worked, we're not certain. This Annistry was from one of the seven major families that fulfilled that obligation of the king. Now, she gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to Ahasuerus. Now, does the palace belong to Ahasuerus or to all the women? Is it just a party for his harem, or is it the wives of all the nobles who were invited? Well, it seems from context it was all the nobles who were invited. It amazed me here in verse 10 on the seventh day. There's so many sevens. There's seven counselors, and there's on the seventh of the month, and there's seven this and seven that. It's a real popular number in this chapter. Now, the seven eunuchs are named in verse 10. They were people of advisors and friendly folks who kind of told him what to do, maybe astrologers and magicians. And we know from history that Ahasuerus, of course, was a devoted follower of Ahura Mazda, which we know as Zoroastrianism. And we see some of the pictures of Ahura Mazda on the reliefs found at Susa. And these eunuchs were his advisors. And he told him to go bring Vashti with all her royal crown. That's funny to me. The older Jewish commentaries, the Targum 1 and Targum 2 and all of that, say that what he wanted to do is come just in her crown. Come naked except for her crown, because he had got drunk and wanted to show off her beauty. But I think the truth is that Josephus tells us, and how much he knows we're not certain always, that Persian women were not allowed to be viewed by strangers. And so the queen did not want to go into this drunken group of men to show off her beauty, and she refuses. And boy, it burnt the king. Ooh. She sent back and said, no, I'm not coming. And boy, he got mad. And then notice in verse 14, these seven princes of Persian Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place of the kingdom. Now, this is what Herodotus, chapter 3, verse 84, mentions these seven families. We find these seven counselors again mentioned in Ezra, chapter 7, verse 14, and they seem to be related here. He gets mad, and the counselors, of course, always agree with the king, and they say, well, this is terrible. Instead of a domestic quarrel, now, of course, the king's embarrassed, but he'll get better when he sobers up. Instead of a domestic quarrel, these advisors say, oh, this is a national problem. If Queen Vashti gets away with disobeying you, all of our wives who are over there with her, they'll start disobeying us, and the women will rebel, and it'll be a national disaster. And the king says, you're right. You're right, and we've got to do something about these wild-eyed, disrespectful women. And so he issues a decree, and remember the law of the Medes and Persians can't be changed. And by the way, we only get that from the Bible. That's not corroborated anywhere else in history, but that's the Bible says that over and over in Daniel and here. Now, so he issues this edict that Vashti be put down from the queen. Now, probably she stayed in the harem. She wasn't vanquished or something, because by being a wife of a royalty, she kind of had royalty given to her. So she couldn't be put away. So apparently her title as queen was taken away, and she was just not called out of the harem. The harem was not available to the king unless he called either by name or asked for a specific person. So he's going to kind of put her away and not call her again. Let's see now. Okay, the decree goes out to all the provinces, and the thing is solved. Now in chapter 2, after these things, when the anger of the king Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti. Now, the older Jewish commentators and Josephus say he regretted what he did. When he sobered up, he just said, well, that was just too harsh, and I shouldn't have done that. Now, these attendants who said, put her away, and she's caused trouble, they realized that if she got back as queen, they were in big trouble. They said, oh, queen, this king, don't take her back. Let's have a beauty contest, and we'll find the best virgins for you, and you can test them all out and find the one you like. And, of course, a lustful king like Xerxes, and we have some accounts of that history, said, hey, that's not a half bad idea. Let's do that. And so he does that. Now, they're going to get these virgins from all over. Look at verse 2. And the king's attendants who serves him, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Now, again, we know from history that after Xerxes tried this campaign, and the reason I say this, there seems to be three and a half or four years between Vashti being deposed and Esther being crowned. Well, that's a long period for the king not to have a queen. But if you put this two-year Greek campaign that failed in that, it seems to fit. We know from history that after his defeat, Xerxes I came back and spent a lot more time with his harem. Well, that fits history and this account very, very well with the dating. Okay? And so he got all his eunuchs together, and they found these young women. Notice it says the harem. Now, the word harem is related to the Hebrew word harem, that means set apart. Now, in the Bible, it's usually set apart for God. Here it's set apart for one particular man, and this place, the king of Persia. It says the king's eunuchs. Now, in the Bible, this word's used two ways. Sometimes of castrated men, and of course, they took care of the harem and were often advisors, but also men who were just high officials. For we know Potiphar in Egypt is called a eunuch, but he has a wife. And so we're not sure all of them were physically castrated, though even Daniel and his three friends may have been. Okay? Notice it says, who was in charge of the women who let their cosmetics be given them. Now, they were really going to dress these girls up. And apparently it took a year. And they were going to give them not only massages and beauty baths and special perfume, they were going to teach them how to act at the court. Okay? And so it took a whole year to prepare these women for that. All right, look at verse 5. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai. Now, Mordecai, we're not certain what that name means. Some try to take it to Marduk or Merodach, these Babylonian deities. But that's not certain at all. Matter of fact, in Ezra chapter 2, Nehemiah chapter 7, and 1 Ezra chapter 5, Mordecai is a name that's mentioned of those who return under Zerubbabel. So whether it's a Jewish name or a Persian name, we're not certain, but that name was somewhat popular to the Jews. Interestingly enough, archaeology has found some cuneiform tablets that mention a Mordecai in connection with the Persian court of this period. Isn't that interesting? His name has been historically corroborated from archaeological cuneiform tablets. Now, it shows his lineage here, and that he was a Benjamite, and it mentions Jair and Shimon and Kish. Now, look at verse 6, who've been taken in exile from Jerusalem. Now, a lot of scholars have said, this means that Mordecai was too old because he was taken in captivity in the first deportation. Remember, there was three deportations under Nebuchadnezzar, 605, 597, and the big destruction and the major deportation in 586. Well, depending on which one you take, and it seems to be that 597 is the one they're referring to, Mordecai would have been over 100 years old here, and Esther would have been pretty elderly herself. So I think it's saying that one of his descendants was taken with Nebuchadnezzar, not Mordecai personally. Now, by the way, Mordecai is always connected with the gate of the palace, and some think he was somehow hired as a watchman or a counselor of the gate. That could be possible. We're just not sure. Now, in verse 7, we have Hadassah. The Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem today means myrtle, okay? Now, her Persian name was Esther. Some think it refers to star, and that seems to be the best possible etymology, although those who have the presupposition will look for Babylonian names say it comes from Ishtar, and there is a possibility there, though star seems to be better. And she was a beautiful lady in face and in form, okay? And Mordecai took her for her own daughter. Now look at verse 8. So it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard that many young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, in custody of Haggai. This is that chief eunuch. And Esther was taken. Now some say this was taken meant she was forced to go. They're trying to answer the question, how would a faithful Jewish be able to partake in all these pagan foods and cosmetic rituals and not observe the Sabbath because she, Mordecai said, don't tell anybody you're a Jew. Well, we don't know that, and some said was taken meant she was taken forcibly. But that can't be true, because look down in verse 15, the very same Hebrew verb is used of Mordecai taking her as his daughter. And she, of course, wasn't taken forcibly there, so this verb does not mean forcibly at all. Notice it mentions many young ladies in verse 8. Now, Josephus tells us there were 400, mercy sakes, 400 concubines or virgins, possible marriage partners for the king or for his harem. Well, that sounds unusual until we learn from Plutarch, another ancient historian, that Artaxerxes had 360 concubines. Man, that's a lot of concubines. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor in him, so he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids in the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther made a real impression on this chief eunuch, and he's going to help her out. And she's going to listen to him, which is really going to be to her benefit. Notice then in verse 12, then when the turn of each young woman, lady came to go into the king Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women. Now, here's the year training. Half was done probably in training them to court etiquette, and half in beauty treatments. Okay? Then verse 14, this is a second harem. There seem to be three divisions of the king's harem. There were his wives, there was his concubines, and there was his virgins. And the second harem seems to apply to these virgins who maybe spent one night with the king and never again were called for. We're just not certain about that. There's too much we don't know here. These concubines, though, even though they only spent one night with the king, were considered somewhat royalty because of that, and they could not marry anybody else or have a normal life. You see some of that in 2 Samuel 16, 20 and following with Absalom, and 1 Kings 1 and 2 with Adonijah in their relationship to David's wives. Okay, you might want to look at that, and Solomon's. Okay, let's see now. All right, let me go to verse 16. Notice the 10th month and the 7th year. This shows there was about 3.5 to 4 years between Vashti being deposed and Esther being crowned. And I think this Greek war fits quite nicely in there. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. Now, he didn't put his other wives away. He wasn't monogamous, but he liked Esther. Okay. And the king gave a great banquet in Esther's honor and all the princes and servants, and he made a holiday for the provinces. Now, a little better rendering of the Hebrew there would be, he let go of taxation and inscription. For some period of time, there was no taxation or no military draft, and that's the reference here. And it was in honor of Esther, his new wife. Now, in verse 19 is one of the most difficult passages in all of the book of Esther as far as the Hebrew text. Now, it says that when the virgins were gathered together the second time, and the second time has been a hassle, was there a second group of virgins that were brought to the capital? And this would imply that Esther won out after a long period of time. A lot of other women had gone in and had been rejected, and they were even planning to bring a second group of virgins in when Esther was chosen. Now, that may be the setting. Some say, though, it's the first group was assembled all together for the second time. They must have been assembled initially, and they were assembled together, in some sense, to honor Esther in her new queen's position. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people. No one knew she was Jewish, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when she was under his care. She was a faithful child, or really she was a cousin, but grew up as a child, okay? In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, now, quite often Mordecai is connected with the gate, and that's why some think maybe he was related as an official or a counselor or something at the gate. We're just not certain. Two of the king's officials from whom guarded the door. These were the king's, probably eunuchs, who guarded the entrance to the king's private quarters. And so they were the very ones who could assassinate him the easiest. Now, the question has always been, how did Mordecai hear about this? Now, the Hebrew text seems to imply he was sitting at the gate and overheard him. This has been amazing to me, some of the Jewish commentators and what they said. In Targum number 1, they say that Mordecai knew all the 70 languages of the world and was able to overhear them and understand them. In Targum 2, it says the Holy Spirit told him. Josephus says that one of the Jewish slaves of one of these men heard about it, and he went and told Mordecai. Well, we just don't know how, but it's amazing how fanciful these stories begin to be embellished. And you can see how the additions to the Septuagint and how the traditions of Josephus, probably oral traditions of the first century A.D., begin to develop around these biblical accounts. And that's where some of these additions come from. It mentions the two men by name here. We know nothing else of them. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king of Mordecai's name, in Mordecai's name. And when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they both were hanged on the gallows, as is written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. And this is not the Chronicles of the Bible. It's the official record of the Persian king. Now, it's interesting that Esther and Mordecai had some degree of communication. Mordecai could not come to the harem, and so apparently had some, through servants or some of these eunuchs, Mordecai may have been an official in the gate, and it had been easier for him to do it. I don't know how, but they had communication. Now, it's interesting that Esther told the king in Mordecai's name, and the king checks it out and finds it to be true, and is going to hang these people. Now, this hanging is apparently a normal way of capital punishment. It's going to be Haman's way to kill Mordecai, try to, later. And so it's a normal pattern. Now, it's interesting here that the king is going to check out Mordecai's story, but in chapter 3, we're going to be introduced to Haman, and he's going to have a story, but the king's not going to check his out. He's just going to act on it. And so it's interesting. We're developing a plot here. Now, I think it's really history, but we're developing this plot. We've got several different actors. We've got Esther, the beautiful Jewish who no one knows, who captures the king's heart. We've got Mordecai, the faithful counselor, who is helping the king and a good servant. And then we're going to have Haman, a jealous person who does not inform the king well and who causes major problems. Now, these are the three motifs that are developed throughout the book of Esther. I hope that what you'll do is sit down and read Esther all the way through at one sitting. And then if you have some commentary on the Bible, maybe a commentary on the whole Bible, or some book to kind of help you get into Esther. Now, be careful of all the theories of authorship. Be careful of all these different plots, what the names mean. Just try to get the story in your mind so we can go through it. It's very important we realize that biblical books are a message. And we have such little time when we meet for Bible study, we don't often get a chance to go through a whole book. And so we get used to just piecemealing these messages. So read the whole book of Esther and do it in several English translations. There's a brand new translation out of the Masoretic text from Jews, which is an excellent alternative English translation that you might want to get. Esther would be in the writing section, the Kithvim, and you might want to read that. And then get in your mind the whole story. And next week we'll be back to look at chapters 3 and 4 as it relates to the developing plot of the palace intrigue. This is almost, you know, you think of one of these soap operas. It's the same kind of thing. The author is so good at relating this account and bringing all the intrigue in and all the all the different actors and all that. It's really a tremendous story. So I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.